This is the Human-Centric Investing Podcast with John Deal, where we look at the world of investing through the eyes of our clients. Take it away, John.
Hello, financial advisors. This is John Deal, Senior Vice President of Strategic Markets at Hartford Funds. Welcome to episode 19 of the Human-Centric Investing Podcast. Back with me today to complete a conversation we had in our last podcast is Stephen Boswell, President of the Oxley Institute. Stephen, thanks for joining me again.
Yeah, you're welcome. Hello, everyone.
Well, in our last podcast, Stephen, we started to talk about the word-of-mouth influence hierarchy, and we had made our way through the first two levels of that pyramid, if you will, of the hierarchy. And I'd encourage folks that are listening today, if you didn't catch that podcast, go back and see if you can listen to that as well. Because just like the influence hierarchy, these levels kind of build on one another. But just so you know, we've created a workbook for this content that you can access in the show notes, or you can go to hartfordfunds.com/influence. Again, it's hartfordfunds.com/influence. And you can look at these materials all in one place. And also a reminder that Stephen is booked for a September 12th webinar, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on September 12th, where we'll be talking about this same material. So mark your calendars. Well, Stephen, last time, as I mentioned, we had made our way through the first two levels of the hierarchy, where we talked about exceeding professional expectations. And then we thought about emotionally connecting with our clients and some of the methods and processes that one might approach those things in with a systematic mindset. The third level of the hierarchy is called activating conversations. What do you mean by activating conversations? And I have a feeling that this is a pretty important part of the process, right?
Yeah, I would say it's hard to say which part is more important than the others, but this one I would say is probably the most critical. It's probably the biggest missing link in the middlers or laggards in their strategy. When we're saying activating conversations, it's based on the premise that, you know, hey, there's a lot of advisors out there who are doing a good job for their clients, and they know their clients pretty well personally, but they're not getting the referral flow they want. And it's a flawed model to say that we're just going to do a good job for people, and they're going to refer us when they feel like it. I should take that back. It's not flawed. It's just not going to put you in a high growth mode like the generators are. So it takes you stirring the pot. It takes you putting them in some situations where it's really natural for them to talk about you. And that's what activating conversations is all about.
So, you know, as I think about this, right, I think you just named it there. We all think that, our clients oftentimes are our friends, right? We've got relationships with them, and we just kind of think that obviously they're telling other people about us, but that's not always the case. And sometimes you feel a little uncomfortable asking for that referral from somebody that you regard as a friend. You've outlined different methods, Stephen, in the workbook that advisors can think about to activate the conversation, make them productive. Can you touch on a few of those and just give us a couple of examples of how this might work for an advisor?
Yeah, and as we had talked about last time, it's not so much asking for referrals in the traditional sense, because it just turns the conversation awkward so quickly that we're trying to think of some other ways that you can get people talking about you without having to resort to that. So if you were to look at some of the core strategies, and again, this comes right out of the advisor and the affluent research, a strategy like arranging personal introductions would be part of a core strategy. So as opposed to asking, John, who do you know that might want to do some business with me? I might identify that, hey, John, I've always wanted to meet Don. What would be the best way to personally introduce me? Just in a social capacity. Maybe we all go out for beers one night, right? So it might sound like semantics, but it's vastly different because I've identified the specific person I want to meet, and I've set it up in a non-threatening venue, just us having beers or lunch sometime. So if you're looking at core activity, something that's repeatable, something that you could be doing every week of the year with great impact, personal introductions is one of the keys.
Well, interesting. You know, we talked in the last podcast about emotionally connecting, and we talked about that kind of the know your client worksheet, if you will, where we're gathering information. If we know that a client of ours is a member of an organization, maybe saying something like, hey, I know you've mentioned John several times, kind of interested in meeting this guy. Is there any way we could meet up? Right. So it kind of connects, like we talked about, to the building blocks that we've already we've already started to build in some of those emotional connections, right?
100%. And if you think about it, is if everybody on your team, whether there's one of you or 20 of you, is focused on what we call sourcing names. And that is nothing more than uncovering names in conversation that your clients are dropping, not to pounce on them, but just to catalog them. If you do that every day of the year, you end up with a great resource, which is every one of your top clients with a web of contacts around them that you know about. And it really sets the stage for some proactive introductions, as we've described. You can do some of that through conversation. You can do some of it through LinkedIn nowadays, just going in and identifying specific people you'd like to meet. Now, how do you activate conversations? Well, sometimes the best way is just to ask, but not to be not to be shy about it. When you look at the close cousin of this, it would be, as we've described in the workbook, social events, guest-worthy social events. So instead of doing it a one-to-one, you know, John, I'd like to meet Don, it might be that we're doing this in a group of maybe 8 to 15 people at a, you know, a minor league game or a beer tasting or a golf clinic or you know, gardening clinic or fashion and finance. You've all, you know, if you've been in the business any amount of time, you have heard some great client event ideas, but how often are you doing these? How systematically are these run throughout your practice?
And what I find, Stephen, is a lot of times the idea of the guest-worthy social event seems a lot more difficult than it actually is, especially if there's someone in the practice that's kind of good at it, kind of arranging these kind of things, that you give a challenge to say, hey, what can we do for our clients that's a little bit different? And I'll add one other thing, is that as we participated in these, I think the guests get as much from meeting other guests, other people in your practice that they've never met before, than they do even participating in the event. Because, you know, look, as we age, sometimes our social circles start to shrink. And it's always nice to meet different people that maybe the one thing we have in common is we use the same financial advisor, right?
Right. Yeah, isn't that neat? You see client bases get to know each other over the years, and I think it increases the loyalty to that advisor.
Absolutely. How about any of the other methods, Stephen, that kind of pop into your mind to say this is something, obviously, you all have seen many of these methods used, but any additional methods you'd highlight?
Yeah, well, when we look at how do you activate conversations, the first two things that came to mind for a reason. They are the biggest things you could do to generate these kind of conversations. When you look beyond that, think about it this way. What if you knew a number last year, the number of times that somebody spoke favorably about you to somebody else? Just any of all of your clients together. It's a number that you will never know, by the way. But let's say, for example, it was 212 times last year that somebody said your name favorably to somebody else. How do we raise that by 5 or 10 or 100? It's done through a lot of little actions. And so with some of these other ideas might seem like fringe actions, but altogether it tends to have you spoken about more frequently. So think about things like this. When you send a client a small gift, is it something that's very visible for other people to see, like some flowers when you know they're having family in for the holidays, or a basket of baked goods sent to their office where you know they're going to be sharing it? So when you send a gift, it's a quick way to get your name in the mouth of your clients, because unless they take credit for this basket of baked goods, they're going to say where it came from. When you're thinking about books and resources that you have, giving clients extra copies of it. We've got some clients who've got in their office a stack of books that are pertinent to business owners, or a stack of books that are pertinent to clients with younger kids. And when they have somebody come in who they know is a good center of influence, they'll give them not only one copy for themselves, but to give them a number of copies and say, hey, I've got a bunch of these. Give them out to a few of your friends. And again, unless they take credit for it, they're going to speak about you when they do so. Drop-ins at their office, you know, calling if you're in the area to say, I want to come by, bring you coffee. It's a good way to meet people. There's just a lot of little things that you can do to get yourself spoken about more often.
Well, and I know in terms of events, you listed a number of different events in our workbook, Stephen, just as examples. But I mean, I would definitely say one of the first things you want to think about when you're thinking about events is what are the things that you, the financial advisor, enjoy, right? Because oftentimes we can get excited, passionate, make it more energetic if it's something we enjoy as well. But I think thinking of, the ability to call a client and say, hey, I'm calling because I thought of you today. I remembered the conversation we had about your love of antique cars, or your love of automobiles in general, or your love of baseball, or your love of whatever it is. And I just want to let you know we're getting an event together probably in about a month, and thought you'd really like to know about it. I mean, I think, again, that whole idea, that's why I think it's so important that the advisors understand what you're talking about in the hierarchy, that one level leads to another, because you've got some great event ideas in our workbook, but obviously not an exhaustive list, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. And the easy part of doing this is coming up with a list of ideas, because if you've been around a little while, you've heard of some great ideas, and it tends to be, when we do a workshop on this and we bring up this topic and we'll say, share with us some ideas, you'll hear, three whiteboards full of ideas on events that people have heard. Then you ask the question, well, how many of these are you doing every year? How systematically are they happening in terms of how you set them up, how you execute, how you follow up? And there's just not that level of excitement when there should be. And if you think about this part of the process, when you think about activating conversations, let's say that once a week, you're asking for a personal introduction using some of the language we shared earlier. And if, let's say, once a month or even once every 2 months, you do a small event that's something fun and unique and interesting enough for them to bring a guest, you're doing better than 95% of the advisor population in terms of activating word of mouth. And it doesn't take that much effort to pull it off.
And Stephen, in terms of results, have you found that client events do or don't make a difference in terms of referrals and things like that?
You know, when people come to us for marketing advice, we give them a short list of options, basically. From our research, there's only so many things that'll work for client acquisition in the affluent space. And we tell them, you don't have to do a balanced approach of all of these things, but you want to get really good at least a couple of them. And one of those almost always is client events, because it's kind of hard to screw up with these things, right? Even if you pulled off an event that you would say is a B-level event, it just wasn't your best, you didn't get much business out of it, more than likely the worst case scenario is that you built on the loyalty of those clients who attended and you had a good time together. It's kind of hard to say that you wasted any money with that approach. Now, if you're really good about it, and this is, you know, it's amazing all the thought that can go into an event to really make it worthwhile from a new business perspective. But if you're really good about it and you're thinking in advance about what events you host, who you'll invite, who they'll invite to come with them, these can be fantastic for a new business. But you've got to have thought about that well in advance of ever organizing or putting this event together.
So, Stephen, the last piece of the pyramid. So, We've moved through the other pieces. We've now got some clients really primed to help us with referrals. The last piece of the pyramid is called refining the narrative. What do you mean by that?
So if we've got some people in your practice who think highly enough about you to tell other people, let's say they're bringing people to your client events, they're recommending you, you want to equip them with a storyline that's compelling. And so we've given a few examples, three things in the worksheet here that we think add to a great narrative. But it's important to look at how you get this information across to them. This doesn't come out as a one sheet you pull together and hand out to all your best advocates. Here's your script. And it doesn't come all in one dump of, you know, let me sit down and I'm going to tell you all my story. Think about it as just spaced repetition over time. You know, that over time, the more you're able to give them information about these three things, and these three things are: your background, basically how you got in the business. Number two, your ideal client profile, who makes a good relationship for you nowadays. And number three, what differentiates you. And if you can get those things across to them over time, they're telling people about you in a much more compelling way than, this is Stephen, my financial advisor, he does a good job.
So Stephen, when I think about your background, right, and I think the way you used it there, it's a little bit different sometimes than what advisors think. Like when we talk about your background, you don't want me necessarily to recite where you got your degrees and how many degrees you got and how smart you are and all that stuff. You're talking more about the emotional side of your background, aren't you? It's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah. And think about that as it relates to maybe the profiles you put up online. So let's say, for example, your LinkedIn profile. How interesting is it to read somebody's LinkedIn profile when all it does is recite where they went to school and what degrees they got and some technical stuff about their current position? It's boring. And the same when you're telling it verbally, it's a lot more engaging when you're saying, well, here's why I got in the business. You know, I grew up, we had no money. I saw family members struggling with this and I was dedicated at that point. So maybe that's your story. Or maybe it is that, you know, I spent the first half of my career in the IT industry and I realized, boy, technology can have a real impact on investing. or you know, any number of things that are just a little bit more of a narrative than they are clinical.
Yep. And why is it important to share your ideal client profile with these folks that may be referring people to you? And what's a good way to do that?
Yeah, and I'll back up a step, John, because I didn't mention really why share your background. And I think, you know, when you think about why your background is helpful, people like to give a narrative when they're explaining a referral. So, for example, if I'm telling you about a painter that I've used, and I'm saying, yeah, he does a great job. Well, you know, you'll notice he got into this business. He's from Nicaragua. He moved here. He got into a car accident. You'll notice he's walking with a limp. If I give you that story, it's a little stickier in your mind than just saying, yeah, he does a good job. Call him. He'll give you a quote. And the same with advisors. If I'm able to say, hey, this is my advisor. You know, he's got a great story. He started off as an IT executive and moved into this industry. You know, I think you'll really value that perspective. It's just a little more compelling.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I'll get back to your original question, which was why the ideal client profile, which is a little bit more directly connected, where you're trying to help them understand the type of people you work best with, and maybe that jogs some thoughts about people they could recommend to you. And so how do you do that without it being a strict, here's the level of assets I seek?
Because
they don't know. They don't know how much money that person has. So you're trying to think about it more in terms of where somebody might live, what stage of life they're in. You're making it real in terms that the client gets and actually has some knowledge of. They don't know their assets, but they might know the line of work or stage of life or what they're into.
And the last piece of this, Stephen, you talk about understanding what your true differentiator means. And obviously, that's something that takes some introspection about yourself or your team. And how can advisors determine this? What do you suggest? How do you define your true differentiator?
This started with some research we did on advisors, and where we asked, what do you think differentiates you? And over half of the respondents came back and said that service differentiated them, which is kind of an oxymoron. If you have over half of the people who say that service is their differentiator, is it really a differentiator?
Good point.
You know, it's got to be really, really, it's not that it couldn't be. It's just got to be super extra special if it's going to be something that sets you apart. And so we try to help them think about it from different angles, because if you just look at the promotional material from advisors, you could say somebody who's brand new to the business says, and they don't, you know, they don't know what they're doing. They just started. They could be saying, I provide comprehensive wealth management. We have the best investment recommendations. Our service is impeccable. And they're saying the exact same thing that Mr. or Mrs. Corner Office, been in the business a long time, is really good. They're saying exactly the same thing. So how do we go at this from a little bit of a different angle? And so we try to give some examples of what a differentiator might be. And it could be maybe a niche market that you specialize in. Nobody knows dentists like us. It could be the fact that your team is really well credentialed and that you've got a CFP and a CFA on staff. And maybe that's part of what sets you apart. It could be that maybe if you're, you know, this, it's always interesting when you try to help an advisor figure out what that real differentiator is, because there's a lot of head scratching going on. One of the ones that people fall back to a lot of times is just maybe your differentiator is a unique personality trait that, you know what, my clients value about me the most is the fact that I'm willing to tell them like I see it, even if it's not advice that necessarily they wanted to hear. They know they're going to get the truth from me. And so there's different ways to spin this, but thinking about what is something that is a little bit unique about you as compared to your competition.
So refining the narrative is really thinking about what my story is so that my best clients or my best connectors will be able to relate that to the people that probably meet our definition of good clients, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the more you can drip those into conversations, the more effectively they get it over time. If you have that conversation with them about your background, like, hey, John, I don't know if you knew this, but I got into this line of work because of A and B and C. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, it may not stick. But if over time, let's say with that ideal client profile, if every, you know, third conversation I'm bringing it up that, well, as you know, we have a real specialty in working with executives with pharmaceutical companies. You're not the only one. We love this market that you're in is really our sweet spot. Right? If I'm able to say that periodically, all of a sudden it's further ingrained in their minds that, hey, Steven's the expert in people like us.
Well, that makes sense. Well, Stephen, to summarize, in the last two podcasts, we discussed what the word of mouth influence hierarchy is and its four levels. So we started at exceeding professional expectations, where we said we constantly have to be reviewing our practice, both in terms of the financial service component, but also communications. And we gave a couple of maybe 14 different things just to start with in terms of examining our practices. Then we went into emotionally connecting with our clients. This is where we dig in and do the emotional work to see what our clients really care about. And then combining those to activate those conversations into ways that clients will actually think about talking about us to other people, and what is the context by which they do that. And then lastly, refining the narrative. If they were going to have a conversation with someone, what story would they want them to tell about us? But so we examined quite a bit, but if you had to summarize the word of mouth hierarchy into a bottom line, what would it be?
Yeah, I think you used the word in intentional earlier, John, and I really like that word. This is being intentional about generating more referral flow, which is more than likely the number one way that you find new business anyway, but it's something that could be improved if you were more intentional and structured about it. So as you think about how to act on this advice, pick out one or two things that you could be more proactive with. You could make the argument that if you said, you know, once a week, I'm going to have a non-business lunch. Once a month, I'm going to have a client event. I'll just about guarantee you that your results are going to pick up if you're really thoughtful about how you're doing these things. But pick one or two. Be consistent with it. It's not something you dabble with.
So if I wanted to get started on making progress in this word of mouth influence hierarchy, Stephen, where should I start? I mean, we already described a pyramid, so I think I know what you're going to say, but, you know, what should be my first step?
Yeah, I think the pyramid's part of it. And the action steps we offer in the worksheet, the number one action step was to evaluate your practice against those 14 criteria, just to make sure, you know, we're not looking to get ready that your practice has to be perfect before you're worthy of referrals, but make sure it's basically in order. And then there's some other action steps. And think through, if you listen to these last two podcasts, was there an idea or two that got your attention, that got you excited? You're going to be, even if I were to rank order things that I think you ought to work on, your own personal rank order is going to be acted on a little bit more quickly because you're excited about doing it. So, you know, we don't have to overthink this. You know, if you're a laggard right now, there's a lot of work to be done. If you're a middler, which by definition, most people listening are somewhere in the middle, getting 3 to 9 referrals from clients that land in new business every year, make some fine tunings. Get up to that generator status. It's a really nice way to grow the business.
Well, Stephen, thanks for all the time that you've given us over these past two episodes. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, well, I love the podcast. Glad to be a part of it. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And for all of those who are listening, just a reminder, if you're interested in any of the materials to accompany the content, you can get that at hartfordfunds.com/influence. And also mark your calendars for the September 12th, 2018 webinar at 4 p.m. Eastern with Stephen. So thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll join you all next time on the Human Centric Investing Podcast.
This podcast is intended for use by financial professionals or in conjunction with the advice of a financial professional. It is intended to be educational in nature and should not be construed as individual investment advice or a recommendation or solicitation to buy, sell, or hold any security or to adopt any investment strategy. It does not constitute legal or tax advice or fiduciary advice pursuant to ERISA rules.
The Oxley Institute is not an affiliate or subsidiary of Hartford Funds.